Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Christy Rosa. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. EncLive is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Lexington, Kentucky for a State of the Science Summit on neuroendocrine tumors. The meeting, led by experts from the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center, spotlighted the latest management strategies in the treatment of patients with neuroendocrine tumors, starting with the diagnosis, classification, and staging of these tumors, to surgery and sequencing approaches with novel agents, such as somatostatin analogs and peptide receptor radionuclide therapy. First, we spoke with Rahim Alkhouli, MD, Assistant Professor of Radiology at the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center. Alkhouli provided insight into the diagnosis, classification, and staging of neuroendocrine tumors, which carry important implications on future treatment directives. Listen on to hear more.
Molecular imaging, you know, everything comes like slowly into the clinical world, so we're still working on proving that where to fit it in the clinical standard. What the clinical community is used to is to do CT, a triple phase CT for a neuroendocrine tumor and see the structure. And even when you treat the patient, you do a CT and see how did the patient shrink or not. And it's good in some cases, and some, it has some limitation. Some cases, the treatment, the cytotoxic treatment will cause necrosis. So the tumor is either gonna be the same size, but it's necrotic, it's more dead cells, or even sometimes increase in the beginning because for the inflammation, necrosis increase and then starts shrinking. So it needs longer time for you to see the structural changes. While molecular imaging will give you a much faster because it's actually going to receptors. So it has to have a living cell expressing the receptor. So you can see the dramatic effect of treatment response faster, for example. But it's taking its time. For now, for example, when you want to stage a patient that you have has neuroendocrine tumor, you do a DOTA-8 PET CT scan to see where the extent of disease, what are the organs that were affected, is there lymph nodes, is there liver mets, is there bone mets, but you still have to do the triple phase CT scan. What we do in our institution right now is we try to alternate. So 6 months we do a DOTA-8, 6 months later we do a triple phase CT, a contrast CT, and then 6 months later DOTA-8. So we kind of have a molecular imaging every year and a structural imaging every year. So we're alternating them. This is what we do in our institution right now. It's not a standard of care yet to do that on patients all the time. Other indications, one of the main indications for DOTA-8 is to assess for eligibility for PRRT, which is the therapeutic arm of this, right? So you want to see that there's enough receptor expressed in that patient. So when I give the therapeutic radiopharmaceutical, it will give value. There is benefit from it. So this is one of the main indications for DOTA-8. In our institutions, we use it for so many things. Like I showed, patients with biochemically suspected, like clinically and biochemically, he looks like a functional neuroendocrine tumor, but structural images like CT cannot, and MRI cannot see anything. We do DOTA-8, and sometimes we find tumors with unknown primary. None of the imaging find where is the primary. We know it's going to be in the small bowel, but where in the small bowel? So when Dr. Kim gets in, he knows where to find it, right? He's not going to go blindly looking for the whole small bowel, which is usually 6 feet, to find the tumor. So there are multiple indications. It's totally replacing Oxford scan. The only time Oxford scan should be done is when you don't have access to DOTA-8. DOTA-8, so it's a gallium-68, for example, DOTA-8 PET-CT, right? The gallium-68 is the radioisotope, which is the radioactive part that our gamma cameras and our PET cameras can see. The DOTA-8 is actually a somatostatin analog. So it, like we showed in the slides, it actually binds to the somatostatin receptors. So when I inject the tracer, the biological part will go and bind to the receptors, and then I can see the radioactive part, which is hooked to it. So it is very valuable, and specifically in well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors, because they still have the receptor expression ability. We see them in other tumors, actually, not only neuroendocrine tumors. Somatostatin receptors are expressed in other tumors like paragangliomas, like meningiomas. We see a lot of other non-NET tumors, but the main scope of it is NET, but it's used also for other indication rather than that.
Next, we spoke with Joseph Kim, MD, FACS, Chief of the Division of Surgical Oncology at the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center, who spoke to the surgical component in NET's treatment. In our interview, Kim reviewed the criteria for resectability, the optimal timing, as well as the risks and benefits of debulking.
Well, there's a number of different reasons why patients may need to get surgery, and that includes having symptoms. So they may have blockages, they may have bleeding, and certainly patients that have limited disease, they may be able to undergo complete eradication of disease. Other patients may have symptoms, and so it's for symptom control, hormonal control. So there's a wide range of indications for surgery. If somebody has disease limited to just the intestine, it's a small resection of the intestinal disease, but many of the patients may have lymph node metastasis, other patients may have dysfunction of the gallbladder, other patients may have metastatic liver disease. So it really has to be individualized. Sometimes the patient that presents with complete bowel obstruction, that's an emergency and there's no question of when that needs to be done. I've had patients with partial small bowel obstruction that we've been able to electively arrange a time for the operation. Since typically this is a disease that is indolent and slow growing, we have time to really think out and plan the operation. There's a fair amount of data that that demonstrates that debulking disease does provide an overall survival benefit. And so the management of this cancer is very different than the other cancers that we treat. And debulking surgery, which typically wouldn't be indicated for other cancers, is certainly a primary indication for NETs. The risks are really on a case-by-case basis, on an individualized basis, depending on the extent or degree of surgery that we perform. Surgery is an important component of the management of neuroendocrine cancers, and we do and can utilize the most advanced technologies that are available today to perform these operations. I think many institutions across the United States still adhere to the standard laparotomy incision, which is a big abdominal incision. And today, using the advanced technologies, we can use smaller incisions and get our patients out of the hospital quicker and have them heal faster.
When we sat down with Aman Chauhan, MBBS, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center, he discussed the medical management of advanced NETs. Until 2018, somatostatin analogs were the primary medical therapy available, but now patients have access to somatostatin analogs as well as PRRT, which doubly work to target symptom burden and cancer proliferation.
Somatostatin analogs are among the first approved therapies for both a syndromic patient, carcinoid syndrome patient, or functional neuroendocrine tumor, as well as for tumor progression. And these approvals were based on two landmark phase 3 studies called PROMID, which led to the approval for sandostatin in functional neuroendocrine tumors, and subsequently CLARINET study, which led to the approval of lanreotide for progressive metastatic neuroendocrine tumors. What we know that the somatostatin analogs, they act on somatostatin receptor 2 and 5 predominantly and help reduce serotonin levels and also slow down the tumor growth. Both these studies led to NANETS, ENETS, as well as NCCN guideline recommendation for the frontline treatment for unresectable metastatic neuroendocrine tumor. And in my opinion, they form the backbone of our neuroendocrine tumor management. The FDA approvals or labels for these two drugs are very narrow and distinct from each other. Sandostatin has been approved for control for carcinoid syndrome, and lanreotide has an approval for progressive disease. However, based on enormous clinical data, we believe that these two drugs are essentially interchangeable in the clinical context, and both NCCN as well as NANETS recommends it for treatment of carcinoid syndrome or functional neuroendocrine tumor as well as tumor progression. So I personally do not have any preference of one over the other. A lot of time it depends on local factors and financial factors and which drug's going to be better covered by a particular insurance. And also the mode of administration, sandostatin is deep intramuscular, whereas lanreotide is deep subcutaneous. So in case if patient has any particular preference. As far as the toxicity profile is concerned, I think they're very equivalent. I personally not have any major issues regarding toxicity, one drug versus other. SSAs are among the relatively most benign treatments for a metastatic disease, at least for neuroendocrine tumors, and should always be employed first rather than jumping on targeted therapies, chemotherapy, and PRRT. Of course, there are nuances and there are decisions we have to make on case-by-case basis, but by far for majority of our patients with progressive disease or uncontrolled syndrome, I rely on somatostatin analogs. The question is, should we continue analogs once patient has already failed or progressed through somatostatin analogs? And we don't know the answer to that yet. There are times where I have continued somatostatin analogs if I've seen the bulk of disease was well controlled and there were just few focal areas which progressed and I added an additional therapy to cover for that. But this is an area of debate, and we need to do more studies to figure out if there's a role of SSAs beyond progression in non-functional metastatic neuroendocrine tumors. PRRT stands for peptide receptor radiotherapy. It's a novel form of administering radiation via, it's an injectable form. So the radioactive moiety is attached to a somatostatin analog, which goes and binds to somatostatin receptors. PRRT-based therapies have been quite prevalent in Europe for good 10-15 years now, and hundreds if not thousands patients have been already treated, and is considered standard of care in Europe for a long time. However, there was a deficiency of a well-run randomized phase 3 trial to clearly delineate the clinical benefit in terms of progression-free benefit. And finally, last year, Dr. Strasberg led a clinical trial called NETTER-1, which is a randomized phase 3 control trial, international trial, which concluded a significant improvement in progression-free survival benefit between the Lutathera, which is the PRRT arm, versus the control, which is high-dose somatostatin analog arm. And based on these findings, FDA finally approved it in 2018. So we have access to PRRT now in the United States, and I think it is one major step in the right direction, at least in my area of expertise. Oftentimes we use PRRT when patient has progressed through one or two lines of therapies, especially somatostatin analog. If a patient is non-functional, that means not secreting hormones, theoretically we should hold somatostatin analog and move to the next line of therapy, which would be PRRT. But there is a growing debate regarding continuing somatostatin analog beyond progression and adding it to PRRT. And in fact, recently there is data supporting this approach. There was a study published in Clinical Cancer Research last year, wherein the investigators from Bonn Hospital in Germany evaluated two groups of patients, one getting PRRT alone, and the second group getting PRRT along with a somatostatin analog. And they found a significant difference in improvement of progression-free survival curves and overall survival curves in the group which got both somatostatin analog and PRRT. They also did, interestingly, a couple of subgroup analyses, and they found that in patients, especially with high bulk disease, patients with grade 2 or Ki-67 more than 10%, and patients with elevated 5-HIAA, those were especially the ones which benefited from continuing or adding somatostatin analog to PRRT-based regimen. I personally feel that there is a role for continuing somatostatin analog beyond progression. But again, I think the prospective data to confirm this is missing and I think is really needed.
Finally, we were joined by the chair of the meeting, Lowell B. Anthony, MD, FACP. In our interview, Anthony explained that the addition of everolimus and telitrostat ethyl to the treatment arsenals in NETs and carcinoid syndrome, respectively, is helping to achieve disease control and manage adverse events. Several emerging therapies have the potential to push the envelope even further, said Anthony, who is chief of the Division of Medical Oncology at the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center. Listen on to hear important data that have shaped the current NETs treatment paradigm.
What was amazing about the RADIANT-2 trial is that it was the very first trial that gave us an indication that there was an active agent, everolimus, for lung neuroendocrine tumors. We'd never had anything for lung before. The somatostatin analog, octreotide, was approved for carcinoid syndrome and for VIPomas, not approved for lung NETs. So the RADIANT-2 trials were practice-changing. It did take the RADIANT-4 for it to get registered as an agent or an indication in neuroendocrine tumors, not only of the lung, but GI tract. The pancreas primaries had been registered about 5 years earlier in 2011. So I've also been asked to talk about the role of serotonin in carcinoid syndrome. We know that serotonin is a key mediator in carcinoid. We know that there's basically three areas in the body that serotonin is made. One is in the enterochromaffin cells that line the gut epithelium. One is the myenteric plexus of the GI tract. And the third is the central nervous system. A few years ago, we had an inhibitor of serotonin synthesis introduced into standard of care. This was about 5 years after the Telestar trial was initiated and eventually telitrostat was approved for diarrhea control that's not adequately controlled with the somatostatin analog. So telitrostat that inhibits the first enzymatic process in the conversion of dietary tryptophan to serotonin is used in conjunction with the somatostatin analogs, octreotide or lanreotide, in the management of carcinoid syndrome. The sequencing of chemotherapy and targeted therapies such as everolimus or sunitinib, somatostatin analogs, is such now that we have choice. Generally, the backbone of management are the somatostatin analogs, lanreotide, octreotide. When patients fail the somatostatin analogs, this is where the sequencing comes in. If they have high bulk and grade 2, then patients would probably benefit from capecitabine and temozolomide, maybe even before the somatostatin analogs. If they're syndromic, it'll be in combination with the somatostatin analogs. And then, once a patient may fail the somatostatin analogs and may not have high bulk, then the use of everolimus or sunitinib becomes a choice. And there, it's really dealer's choice. There's no data-driven information that guides the practitioner. So it's really the comfort level of the provider as it relates to toxicities, because basically the patients are going to get both an mTOR inhibitor, everolimus, and a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, sunitinib. What we now also have is PRRT as a another alternative in the sequencing of somatostatin analogs, to chemotherapy, to targeted therapy, and now to injectable radioisotopic therapy is becoming more of an issue. Do we do PRRT after they fail the somatostatin analogs, or in some patients, do we even start with PRRT in those patients who have widespread bony disease where we know PRRT is particularly effective? So I think the really good news is that our patients' outcomes are significantly better now than they've ever been because we have more choices as it relates to control the disease. And not only to control the disease, but we have more choices so that we can control the side effects of the disease and not have toxicities that are unexpected. Emerging therapies that we should be aware of for neuroendocrine tumors would be the tyrosine kinase inhibitors for the grade 1 well-differentiated intestinal NETs. Cabozantinib, lenvatinib, these trials show promise. The cabozantinib trial is in progress, so I think it's just a matter of 2 to 5 years until we'll have more choices in GI NETs similar to the same that we have it in pancreatic NETs. Other areas will be immunotherapy. The trial that was reported recently in Europe looking at PDR-001 or spartalizumab showed benefit for thoracic NETs. In other areas, looking at immunotherapy, it's going to be a little more challenging, maybe looking at some combination or different approaches to really the immunotherapy, but I think that is an emerging area that we should have greater signals of the usefulness in the next 5 years. So spartalizumab is a PD-L1 and 2 inhibitor. This is a monoclonal antibody, an IgG4, that has been tested in prospective randomized trials in not only three primary sites of neuroendocrine tumors, but also poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma. Of the trial that was done, we can see that there were more responses, and this is just looking basically at radiographic responses rather than time to progression to date. There were seen a greater response rate in these thoracic primaries. Historically, there had been another trial with pembrolizumab that suggested response rates around 6 to 12%, and for TNETs, we're seeing it much more in the 30% range. So we're quite pleased for these early signals. We don't know exactly how it's going to translate into practice. It's probably a little bit early. Sometimes these phase three trials, or this is actually a large phase two, doesn't really translate into a successful registration in large phase three trials. The important aspects that we can take away from the management of neuroendocrine tumors today is that there's never been a better time in managing these patients. Patients are very much individualized, and our ability to choose what we think is the best personalized therapy for that patient is such now that we expect these patients to live for many years. And I think that's starting to show in the SEER data. SEER data from the NCI always lags 5 or 10 years. And as these advances have occurred in this decade, we will be seeing significantly improved outcomes in decades to come. What I would like for oncologists to take away from these talks is that this is a new day in the management of neuroendocrine tumors. We have a cadre of agents and treatments available, procedures available, that we can improve patient symptoms. We can have adequate side effects from these treatments, and we can significantly improve outcomes, and specifically survival and quality of life both.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn more about the recent progress made in hematologic malignancies, consider registering for the August 15th State of the Science Summit in Los Angeles, California. We'll also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on September 10th in Durham, North Carolina, which will focus on advances made in breast cancer. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit. And don't forget to follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thank you again for listening to OncLive On Air.